second case and last one for today, 00-0003, Darren Reed versus Attorney Frederick Smith will argue for American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm here to represent American Family Mutual Insurance Company in this case. This case is up before the court on certification from the Court of Appeals. And the certified issue is whether the decision of this court in Elliott versus Donahue to award attorney's fees to the insured was premised upon the insurer's contractual breach of the duty to provide coverage or the duty to defend or both. It is our position that regardless of how that issue is determined, American Family did not breach any duty owed to its insured in this case, and therefore the award of fees by the trial court should be reversed. This case can be reversed while still preserving the Elliott decision by ruling that Elliott was based on the breach of the duty to defend and that the damages awarded in Elliott, both for refusing to defend the defense costs and for establishing coverage, were a natural and proximate cause of the breach of the duty to defend. Proving that the insurer breached its duty to defend in Elliott necessarily involved
counsel,
proving that...
Before you go on to that, I'm having a difficult time determining the difference between breach of the duty to provide coverage or the duty to defend or both. Coverage, I mean, to me, it always seems that part of the coverage is the duty to defend. That if I've got coverage, you're going to defend me. Why are they different?
I believe I have the same problem, exact same problem. I've always viewed an insurance contract as having two principal duties, defense and indemnification. When you characterized a duty to provide coverage, I think that if you look at what one of the amicus briefs pointed out, I believe this court or the Court of Appeals has characterized the duty to provide coverage as including both the defense obligation and the indemnity obligation. I would frame the issue from the Court of Appeals in terms of the duty to defend or the duty to indemnify or both. That's how I would view it. The duty to provide coverage, I believe, encompasses both of those obligations. What we have in this case is a situation where American Family was sued as a defendant under the direct action statute, and it immediately assumed the defense of its insured. Mr. Reed, the plaintiff in this case, was a courier working for a building contractor in Milwaukee. He had been sent out to the home of Leanne and Ralph Benz in Mequon to obtain a seal on some architectural blueprints. He slipped on the driveway and then initiated a lawsuit. He sued both Leanne Benz and American Family. American Family answered and asserted a coverage defense and also promptly assumed the obligation to defend Mrs. Benz. There was never any dispute in this case about the duty to defend. I think that the key in resolving this case and in resolving the certified issue is to look at the Elliott decision itself and to also look at the cases since Elliott that this court and the Court of Appeals have decided. In Elliott, the court came out and stated first, discussed the Mowry decision, and it discussed the duties of what an insurance company is obligated to do. And it stated that to be entirely consistent with Mowry, the insurer should not only request a bifurcated trial on the issues of coverage and liability, but it should also move to stay any proceedings on liability until the issue of coverage is resolved. That's exactly what American Family did in this case. It followed the dictates of Mowry.
Could I ask one sort of historical fact? On the question of coverage, who fired the first shot?
I believe that there was a scheduling conference. The court issued an order based on stipulation of the parties that the parties would file cross motions on that issue. And I believe that American Family first filed a motion for summary judgment, not a motion for declaratory judgment. And then I believe that Ms. Benz filed a motion for declaratory judgment on the same issue.
Well, now, if American Family filed the motion for summary judgment first, why didn't that trigger some obligation to pay reasonable costs incurred?
Why didn't that trigger an obligation to pay reasonable costs incurred with regard to that motion?
Yeah, that's the second argument of the Elliott case.
You're referring to the argument in Elliott about proving or establishing coverage, I believe, so we're on the same page. The difference is that in Elliott, there was a breach of the duty to defend. If you look at the cases subsequent to Elliott, Newhouse versus Citizens Security Mutual Insurance Company, Town Realty is another case. Both of those cases, this court set forth the breach of the duty to defend doctrine. And in both of those cases, the court ruled that proximate cause of the breach of the duty to defend can result in both the costs incurred in defending oneself and in establishing coverage. If you look at the Court of Appeals cases since then, the Radke versus Fireman's Fund case and the Loosemore versus Parent case, in both of those cases, particularly Loosemore, which is, in my opinion, identical to the Elliott case, the court specifically stated that damages naturally flowing from the breach include legal expenses incurred in establishing coverage. I believe that that's the bottom line of Elliott, is that there was a duty to defend both the damages for defending themselves and those incurred in establishing coverage were proximately caused by that breach. That's the way that this court should frame the Elliott case. That's the way it has proceeded, and that's what the trend is in the law since the Elliott case. In Elliott,
you want the court to hold, I just want to understand the argument, that in a bifurcated situation where the insurance company is just debating coverage, right? And agrees that if there's coverage, they will defend, right? And there's a stay on the liability part of the trial, right? That if there's a just debate on coverage and the insurance company loses that debate, when I say debate, I obviously mean a court proceeding, and the insurance company is held to provide coverage, your position is that the insured is responsible for his, her, its attorney fees in challenging a reasonable position by the insurance company that there's no coverage.
Yes, that's what I'm asking the court to do, is to reverse the decision of the trial court, which based the award of attorney's fees on Elliott. In my view, Elliott was based on the duty to defend. It can be characterized that way. And in the absence of some type of a breach, in the absence of some type of unfair action.
Here it's a reasonable dispute among reasonable people.
Yes, exactly.
But from an equitable standpoint, so you're in a battle with your insured wins, then they pay the cost. Insurance companies better able to bear that burden than the individual insured.
If the court wants to expand Elliott,
yeah,
and rule in this case that insureds should never have to pay a dime more than premiums, which I believe is what the core of my opponent's argument is in this case.
Well, I know this didn't get into bad faith. And, you know, I would clearly say, you know, when there's bad faith on part of the insurance company, and it's over a similar, that the insured, when they win, would have their payment, you know, that's a different situation, paid by the insurance company. But you're saying where there's, as long as it's reasonable, then each side should pay their own cost.
Yes, each side should pay their own cost when there's a good faith, reasonable debate on an issue of coverage.
What do you base the argument on? Do you base it on the insurance policy?
I base it on the lack of a provision in the policy that says that an insurance company has to pay when it loses. I base it on the declaratory judgment statute, which seems to be bring into the issue of a breach or an equitable concern. In this case, each party should bear their own fees. Where there is nothing that's inequitable, there is no fault on the part of the insurance company in defending itself in this case, which is what it was doing. If you assume that Ms. Benz wasn't the party, American Family would have raised the exact same coverage defenses with regard to Mr. Reed's lawsuit.
Counsel, you've responded with equity, using that phrase a couple of times, just did in response to the chief. You've also said several times so far, Elliot is based on the duty to defend. Elliot was based on the duty to defend. That's your mantra. I'm not sure what you mean by that. Are you saying duty to defend, is that tantamount to a breach of contract? Is Elliot based on equity, or is it based on breach of contract? When you say it's based on duty to defend.
I believe that the court blended the concepts of breach of contract to find an equitable reason to invoke the jurisdiction of the declaratory judgment statute.
So it's your interpretation of Elliot that, I'm just reiterating to make sure I understand, that the court used the vehicle avenue of breach of contract and arrived at an equitable determination.
Yes.
So their holding was not in breach of contract, their holding was based in equity.
Well, I think if you look at the actual decision in Elliott, the court did set forth equitable considerations from the Appleman Treatise. And the Appleman Treatise was quoted at 322 and 323 of the Wisconsin Reports version. And there the court set forth a long paragraph about breach of the duty to defend. And so it was based on the Appleman Treatise, the fact that when an insurance company breaches its duty to defend, it leaves an insured all alone to defend against a lawsuit. It doesn't comply with the dictates of Mowry, which was before the Elliott case. It doesn't comply with any of the cases subsequent to Elliott and Mowry. And on that basis, I believe that the court can say at this point that Elliott was a breach of the duty to defend case, and that both the damages incurred in defending the action and establishing coverage were approximately caused by the breach of the duty to defend. And that's why, in this case, attorney's fees are inappropriate. Another reason why I think the court should focus on that breach of duty to defend analysis is because the court relied on the Minnesota case of Nordby in the Elliott case. And as I pointed out in our brief, Minnesota has done an about face since then. So the underpinnings of Elliott, insofar as they rely on decisions from Minnesota or decisions from other jurisdictions which cited the Minnesota case of Morrison, those underpinnings have been removed.
Counsel, I just have one question since I have. I'm familiar with the Pulse case that was written by this court about
I'm looking at your opposing counsel's brief, page 30, and they cite, of course, when you were in the House, they say basically that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. It may be triggered even if the insurer's coverage defenses are ultimately accepted. And then they go on to say, on page 31, that the insurer, it is only requires that the insurer, rather than the insurer, to assume the risk that its coverage defenses are wrong. What I'm wondering about is, that goes back to my first question, if you think you buy an insurance policy, you think you're covered by it, and then you, being American Family, say, no, you're not covered. So now we litigate it, and you're saying as long as it's in good faith, and there is some merit, that the insured has to pay covered by your policy.
Yes. The duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And the duty to defend is determined not on what the actual facts are. The duty to defend is determined entirely on what the allegations of the complaint state. If those allegations state facts, which ultimately, if they're proven, would fall within the coverage provided, then there's a duty to defend. If later, at trial, it turns out that those facts are not provable or that the facts are somehow different so as to pull the case out of the coverage, then there's no duty to defend.
I guess what I'm saying, with coverage, I would think you buy the duty to defend. In other words, with coverage, if it's proven that you're covered, then your cost would be covered by insurance. That's what I'm saying. In other words, that's what my concept.
I think this goes back to Justice Babbage's concern about what does provide coverage mean. You have to distinguish between the duty to defend, because that duty is based on something that could be even broader than what the case actually is. And the duty to indemnify, that comes down to whether or not the facts as proven fall within the coverage provided. And that's why the court, over the years, has given the insured a free defense in cases which ultimately might not prove to be covered.
Counsel, why would an insured, in a case involving damages that are roughly equivalent of what his or her attorney fees would be to press the claim, why would an insured ever press a questionable claim?
Why would an insured ever press?
Why would an insured sue? Because let's say you've got a claim for $5,000, and the attorney fee, you go into the attorney's office, and the attorney says it's going to cost you $5,000. Well, so even if he wins, even if the insured wins, he wins nothing. He's spent $5,000. He gets $5,000, turns around and endorses the check back over to his lawyer. So why should an insured in those small claims, essentially small cases, which I would assume a company like American Family has literally thousands of these in a year, why should an insured ever go after American Family for coverage?
I think that what you'll find in practice is that you're right, American Family has a lot of these small types of cases, and in practice for them, it's more economically wise to just settle those cases rather than push coverage defenses. I can agree with you that if an insured looks at a case and says, this case is not worth a dime more than $5,000, my total exposure in this case is $5,000, and if I have to litigate a coverage issue, it may be more economically wise for the insured to just pay that settlement and then either file a subsequent lawsuit to have the American Family pay that settlement amount or just drop it altogether. I think that's the reality of litigation and parties. I can't tell you that there's going to be a situation that an insured is going to be better off in every single situation. On the other hand, if you look at, if this was a $50 million case, and the insurance company brought up a coverage issue, and it turned out to result in $7,000 in fees, you know, then you'd have a much bigger stake in things. And then certainly, I don't think you would be looking at the unfortunate circumstance of the insured, as some people are characterizing it in this case, where you have a $10,000 settlement with $7,000 in fees.
Except the insured wouldn't be too interested because they're going to be judgment-proof. So what you're really doing is having a fight with the injured party.
The plaintiff, over whether or not they're going to get the money from American Family or from the negligent tort fees.
Mr. Smith, we have had a number of underinsured motorist cases this term. In these cases, to the best of my recollection, we don't have the question of duty to defend. We have coverage issues. Is it your position that under no circumstances is the insurance company responsible for it? Attorney fees in trying to establish coverage in these cases?
I think when you have a first-party contract, the tort of bad faith is certainly something that the court can consider if they find that the insurance company denied an uninsured motorist claim in bad faith. The natural and proximate result of that breach would be attorney's fees, certainly. To answer your question, I think in that situation it should be limited to the tort of bad faith as providing the means of recovery in general.
Counsel, your interpretation, as I understand it, would be, look, almost handle it on the individual situation under 806.04 equitable grounds.
I think that what the court should do is rule that if there is no breach of any duty to an insured, there can be no recovery under 806.04 or under any other legal or equitable theory. There has to be some breach of duty on the part of the insurance company.
The question asked earlier by Justice Prosser causes me some concern, and that is that the procedural difference between bringing the issue before the court in a summary judgment and bringing it before the court in a declaratory judgment. In a declaratory judgment, you have the language of 806.04 sub 8 and then sub 10, which allows for equitable costs, including attorney's fees. Wouldn't have that in summary judgment. So if you are basing your argument on equity and someone brings a summary judgment, how does that connect?
The items of cost statute limits the recovery of attorney's fees to $100.
Is that under 814?
Yes.
Yes. So that just doesn't seem like that's just fortuitous. I mean, the law can't be dependent on such fortuity, putting summary rather than declaratory. I mean, there has to be a broader principle.
You look at what the trial court did in this case. I made that argument in the trial court initially, that this was not a declaratory judgment action, and therefore the declaratory judgment statute could not apply. And the trial court looked at it and said, well, Mrs. Benz is asking for a declaratory judgment. Couldn't it apply in this case, even though it's not a declaratory judgment action? And I think that the court could, in situations where there is a pending motion for summary judgment, apply the declaratory judgment statute when the real relief is asking the court to declare what the rights of the parties are. A summary judgment, we sought dismissal from the lawsuit. We were sued as a defendant. We wanted to get out of the lawsuit as a defendant. That's why we filed a motion for summary judgment. So that's how the trial court handled that issue. If the court wants to go down that road here, I don't think that that's any problem to my position.
Let me ask this. Suppose the court were to rule that somehow American Family had breached a duty to provide coverage. Just lay out for us the parade of horribles that's going to follow from that.
One of the amicus briefs does that. And what I would like to do, I know I'm running short on time, but if you would look at the brief of the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers, my opponent, I went through and I looked at all those cases. And you'll find cases after those Nebraska, Ohio, New Hampshire cases where a plaintiff, an injured party, is claiming a right to fees, where even though the insured loses on a coverage issue, he's claiming that he has his right to have his fees paid. You'll find cases where the court is stuck in a position where they can't base it on anything other than who won and who lost. And in one case, the court said that because the insurance company filed the coverage issue, which it lost, it put its own interests above those of the insured. And I don't see the logic in that. They filed a meritorious coverage issue, and it turned out that it wasn't accepted. But I don't think you could say in that situation, which was a UM case, I'm talking about the McGreevy case out of Washington, that that's logical or that it's equitable or that's based on anything, any type of statute or common law that would allow for the recovery. Thank you.
Deputy Counsel, Attorney O'Brien.
Thank you and good morning. I am Tamara O'Brien and I represent Leanne Benz, who purchased a policy of liability insurance from American Family. She recently expected to receive financial protection in exchange for her insurance premiums. But when a slip and fall claim was brought against her, she has since spent more litigating coverage with American Family than was ever paid to settle the claim. We are asking this court to confirm that the decision awarding attorney fees in Elliott was not a sanction. Those attorney fees were not awarded as a sanction for a breach of any duty, but to restore to the insured the benefits of defense and indemnity, which are purchased with the insurance premiums. It was firmly grounded in the equitable principles, which the court can consider under the declaratory judgment statute, and we're asking the court to confirm that the same equitable principles, which led to the award of attorney fees in Elliott, apply in this case as well. And to all, I would like to elaborate on those points because I think Elliott was based on the unique nature of the insurance contract, which makes it unlike any other contract, and on the language of the insurance policy. I would also like to address some of the new issues that were raised by some of the amicus insurer parties, particularly the authority of the court to award attorney fees in this case, the distinctions that are drawn between the defense and indemnity obligation, and the supposed impact of affirming the award of attorney fees in this case. As to the nature of the insurance, the Elliott Court recognized, this court recognized in Raff Elliott, that liability insurance contracts are in fact unique, not because of the fiduciary nature of the insurer-insured relationship or the good faith obligations that are attendant, but because insurance is by definition a means of transferring risk from the insurer to the from the insured to the insurer. The insurance company is in the business of evaluating risks, accepting premiums to assume those risks, and then spreading the costs of those risks. And as to the language of the liability policy at issue both in Elliott and here, the court recognized that insurance coverage is comprised of two distinct benefits, defense and indemnity, both of which are to be provided at the insurer's expense in exchange for insurance premiums. Significantly, the liability policies at issue limit the insured's liability to the payment of insurance premiums. this combination of factors, the nature of insurance and the language of the policy, is what makes the insurance contracts unique. If you contract to buy a widget and you have to litigate to obtain the widget, you, if you win, you get your widget. You've paid more for it in terms of litigation costs under the American rule, but you still receive the widget. When Leanne Benz and every other consumer of personal liability insurance pays premiums to obtain a liability policy, they expect to receive protection from financial liability, defense, and indemnity at the insurer's expense. If you have to litigate to prove that you're entitled to that liability protection, not only is the risk of loss unfairly transferred from the insurance company to the insured, but the insured is deprived of the financial protection that they purchased in the first place, whether they win or lose.
Could I ask you to respond? Are you saying that something like underinsured motorist is not liability coverage? Is that a different kind of policy? How do you distinguish that?
Most underinsured motorist policies are different because, first of all, there isn't the duty to defend, but I don't think that's the critical factor. I think the touchstone of any analysis, whether it's under a first-party policy or a liability policy, is whether the insured has been deprived of the benefit that was promised under the policy. In most UIM policies, the insured pays premiums, but the contracts also contemplate that there will be arbitration, that the insured will pay the cost of their selected arbitrator, and in that situation there may or may not be a demand for equity to restore benefits to the insured. In liability policies, in contrast, the insured's liability is limited to the insurance premiums, and because of the very essence of liability coverage is financial protection, there's no way that the insured can obtain that protection if they have to pay more than in their insurance premiums to defend an unsuccessful challenge to coverage. The amicus insurers have challenged the court's authority to award attorney fees under the American rule, claiming that the declaratory judgment statute doesn't provide expressly for attorney fees and also that the policy language doesn't apply for them. Permit an award of fees. And I'd like to spend some time addressing this issue because I think it's key to the equity arguments and the equity rationale of the Elliott decision. The decisions in Community Care of Milwaukee County, the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, and others relied upon by the amicus insurers acknowledged, as this court did in Elliott, that the court has in fact crafted limited and narrow exceptions to the American rule where there is a legislative intent to grant the court discretionary authority to afford full relief. Even the decision in the Alaska pipeline case simply affirmed that the court should not award attorney fees without legislative guidance. But in this case, we do have legislative guidance in the terms of the declaratory judgment statute. In Watkins versus LIRC, that was one of the cases cited by the amicus insurers, while recognizing the validity of the American rule, this court found that the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act implicitly authorized the Department of Industry and Labor Review to award attorney fees to a prevailing victim of discrimination. And the decision is compelling in this case because in reaching its decision, the court focused on three aspects of the Fair Employment Act that have direct parallels to the Declaratory Judgment Act. First, the court focused on the purpose of the Fair Employment Act to make victims of discrimination whole. It's a remedial purpose. Second, the court noted that the act directs that it be liberally construed to affect the purpose of the act. And finally, and most significantly, the court noted that the act directs the Department of Industry and Labor to make findings and orders appropriate to carry out the remedial intent of the statute. The court concluded that the authority to award attorney fees can be fairly implied from this combination of statutory provisions and the broad remedial mandate for the court to fashion a remedy appropriate to make the victim whole. The court court in rendering its decision relied in part on federal court decisions that it relied on similar broad remedial mandates to award attorney fees even when they're not explicitly called for by a statute. In Elliott, this court found that the broad remedial provisions of the declaratory judgment statute provide a statutory basis for the award of attorney fees where equity demands further relief. Specifically, Section 806.04 sub 12 defines the purpose of the declaratory judgment statute to be remedial. The same subparagraph directs that the statute is to be liberally construed. And most significantly, again, subsection 8 explicitly authorizes the court to grant further relief whenever necessary or proper to accomplish the remedial objective. So just as the Fair Employment Act did in Watkins, the Declaratory Judgment Act, in its further relief provision, expressly contemplates that the court will have that authority to fashion a remedy appropriate to accomplish the remedial objective of the statute.
Ms. O'Brien, in the Elliott case, the Mowry dictates word follow. In this particular case, it looks like everything we said in Mowry should be done was done. Isn't that a significant distinction?
I don't think that it is, because I don't think that the award of attorney fees in Elliott was awarded as a sanction for the breach of the duty. The court expressly stated that the purpose of the award was to preserve for the insured the benefits of defense and indemnity which are purchased with the insurance premiums.
Well, in cases subsequent to Elliott, haven't we tried to limit Elliott to its facts? Haven't we tried to say that Elliott was a particular fact situation and it should be limited to its facts?
The court has, and the courts can successfully do that because the Elliott court was crafted based on the unique nature of the insurance contract and the policy of the insurance, the language of the insurance policy. For example, in DeShant, the court affirmed not only that Elliott stands for the proposition that courts do have the equitable authority to award attorney fees, but further that the award of attorney fees in Elliott was firmly grounded within the statutory framework of the declaratory judgment statute. In that case, attorney fees were awarded as compensatory damages for the tort of bad faith. But in Orton, that's a good example of a situation where, you know, the question phrased by the court in Gordon was whether the equitable principles that apply to attorney fee awards under Elliott apply if the insured has already been made whole. Because in that case, the insured not only recovered damages in the underlying product liability action, but also had received a portion of the statutory fee award that had been made to their counsel. In that situation, the insured had been made whole, and the equitable principles did not warrant an award of attorney fees. In this case, as in Elliott, Ms. Benz has not been made whole. She has not received defense and indemnity in exchange for her insurance premiums. She didn't receive the financial protection she purchased from American Family.
If the plaintiff in Groton had not been made whole, is your argument then that attorney's fees should have been awarded?
I think the touchstone for the analysis is whether the claimant, the party claiming attorney fees, has been deprived of a benefit promised. In Gordon, there was a dispute over, it didn't involve an insurance contract.
That's what I was getting to.
That's my
follow-up question.
Right.
You seem to be implying that the touchstone of your analysis is whether equity and whether someone is made whole, and yet moments ago your analysis was in part dependent on the uniqueness of the insurance contract. And of course, Broughton didn't involve an insurance contract, so
right.
It's not clear to me.
Well, I will go back because I think the insurance policy and the unique nature of insurance is the reason why the equitable principles demanded restoration of benefits to the insured, because the very essence of liability insurance is financial protection from financial liability, and that is the basis for distinguishing and narrowing Elliott to the particular circumstances, those limited circumstances that were before the court of Elliott and that are before the court now.
So American Family or any insurance company, they don't feel that there's coverage and there is legitimate as this the risk they take is that if they lose, that you want from them to pay. The attorney said the difference, as I see it,
what if somehow they make a mistake and move summary judgment rather than declaratory judgment?
Well, if the insurance company moves for summary judgment, I think the equitable goal of restoring the benefit of the insurance policy, the liability protection, can be applied by the court regardless of whether the motion is one for summary judgment or for declaratory judgment. Because it's the only way to preserve for the insured the benefits that are promised by the insurance policy.
I think the question is, what if the insured uses the procedural mechanism of summary judgment to litigate the coverage dispute, which is usually how it's done, right?
In other words, there's no declaratory judgment. Everybody is going in on summary judgment because, after all, the result is the same. What you're saying is, on the basis of these facts, which are undisputed, what is the legal rule? So it really doesn't matter whether we call it summary judgment or declaratory judgment, unless you're going to tie in attorney fees.
Right, and this goes back to Justice Bradley's question. This should not all rise or fall on the procedural hook that's used.
No, it shouldn't.
It's all one case. The issues are typically bifurcated for litigation purposes. And in the ordinary course, there's not usually a declaratory judgment action filed. In this case, there was a motion for declaratory judgment. But, you know, it's not technically a separate action for declaratory judgment. It's really just a summary judgment motion by another name, which may or may not give rise to attorney's fees under Elliott.
And I think the same argument can apply to the fact that whether you characterize this as a motion for summary judgment, regardless of the procedural mechanism used, regardless of which party files the motion first, the question is whether the insured was afforded the benefit of the policy. And we can characterize that either under the equitable base provisions of the declaratory judgment statute, which provide a statutory basis for the award, or you can characterize the failure to provide indemnification in exchange for nothing more than insurance premiums as, in essence, a breach of the duty, and then the damages flow as a natural consequence of the failure to provide the benefit by the policy.
What are the benefits promised by the policy? They are, number one, the insurance company says, we'll pay any damages that you're found liable for, right? That's the duty to indemnify.
Correct.
Number two, we will provide a defense for you.
Correct.
On the underlying claim, that's the duty to defend, right? And the insurance company does not say in the contract, we will pay your costs, including reasonable attorney's fees, incurred in any dispute that arises between us about the applicability of this contract in the first instance.
But what the insurance policy does promise is to provide the benefits of defense and indemnity in exchange for insurance premiums.
Defense on the underlying action, though, not defense on any dispute that arises between the parties to the contract over the applicability of the contract.
But you cannot obtain a benefit of indemnity in exchange for insurance premiums if you have to litigate and pay more than your premiums to obtain that benefit.
Right, but let's focus on what a coverage dispute is all about. A coverage dispute is all about the applicability of the contract in the first instance. It's not really about, you know, the truth or falsity of the underlying claim and who's liable to whom on the tort, right? Because that's, you know, that's for later on, and that's why we bifurcate these issues. It's really a contract dispute between two people. Well, the insurance company and the insured. And there isn't anything in the insurance contract or in the common law of insurance contracts that says, as to that dispute, the contract either explicitly or implicitly requires the insurance company to pay the insured's costs for litigating a contract issue like that, right?
I guess I would respectfully disagree, because you cannot obtain financial liability protection if you pay more than your premiums. And the courts have, in Wisconsin at least, have never hesitated to place the risk of coverage determinations on the insurer rather than the insured. We construe ambiguities in the policy in favor of coverage. We provide that if the insured doesn't assume the defense, then it waives its coverage defenses. There are all sorts of protections that are attendant on an insurance policy because of the good faith obligations and the control that's surrendered to the insurance company that make it unlike any other contract. And I think that's why, and I think that's what the court recognized in Elliott, that's why the insured, even in the separate litigation over the coverage provided by the policy, is entitled to be restored the full protection promised by the policy if the insurer is wrong. And I think that's another important point, is that the attorney fees are not awarded simply because the insurance company has chosen to contest coverage. They have every right to do that. But if they are wrong, and the insured has to bear the expenses of that litigation, then it's the insured that is assuming the risk and not the insurer. The impact of this...
Your argument is that the insurance policy requires or promises to pay the cost of defending the suit and to pay damages. That's what the...
Correct.
American Family promise. That if American Family disputes coverage and loses, that if the American Family doesn't pay the attorney fees, then the insured is not getting the full costs, which the American Family promised to pay, of defending the lawsuit. Because the defense of the lawsuit is in two parts, one coverage and one defending. If they lose the coverage, it's really part of the costs of defending this entire lawsuit. Is that your argument? Anyway, that's what I understood. That you cannot obtain full indemnification of the cost of defending if there's a fight over coverage and the policy. Insurance company loses.
No, I think the two benefits are distinct. There's the duty to defend a third-party claim that's brought, and there's the duty to pay damages should the insured become liable to pay damages.
All right. But you've been asked, in effect, where under the policy does American Family promise to pay attorney fees for a fight about coverage? That's the question, and I think that's a good one, because I think that rights under the contract have to be found in the contract. And it seems to me that you have to then find the right of payment of insurance policy, payment of attorney fees, in one of the two promises, pay damages or pay the cost of defending. And I'm trying to say to you, which is what I heard, but maybe I am imposing my analysis from what I heard, not your analysis. And I, what I heard is, if the insurance company attempts, if the insurance company promises to pay the cost of defending, and if the insurance company disputes coverage and loses, in effect, this dispute about the coverage is part of the defense under the policy. And therefore, attorney fees should be paid. What do you think of that? Even if it's not your argument. I mean, you have to get it under the policy, so we have to... I mean, that should be... You have to make an argument, unless you're going to rely solely on form of declarative judgment and summary judgment.
The insurance policy provides defense in exchange for premiums. Right. Under a separate provision, it agrees that it will pay damages. And it promises to provide both of those in exchange for insurance premiums.
Right.
The policy also provides that it will pay any other reasonable expenses incurred at the request of the insurance company, which the insured incurs at the request of the insurance company. The court in Elliott recognized alternatively a line of cases where the courts have found essentially that by engaging the insured in a coverage contest unsuccessfully, the insurance company is essentially asking the insured to incur expenses for which it promises to reimburse them if necessary, if there's coverage found. So whether you proceed under the statutory basis of the declaratory judgment statute, which permits the court to look at the equitable and unique nature of liability protection.
Isn't that latter argument going to be available in all insurance coverage disputes, not just what you call the liability coverage?
If the policy expressly provides that the carrier will pay expenses incurred by the insured at their request?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that any policies but liabilities policies contain that clause, but...
Well, usually uninsured or underinsured are in liability policies, but they usually are a separate provision, and I don't know if this covers, but that's what the question is.
I guess
I'm a little slow this morning, but you started out with a hypothetical about widgets, and then you went to insurance coverage in a liability context, and I wasn't quite gathering what the great distinction was. And then you came along and said insurance policies are unique and special, but not all of them. And I'm having a little bit of difficulty trying to get at the rule.
The policy at issue in Elliott and the policy at issue in this case promises, again, to provide the benefits of defense and indemnity in exchange for insurance premiums, so that the very essence of what Leanne Benz was purchasing with her premiums is protection from having to pay anything more than her insurance premiums if she is sued. When the insurance company engages the insured in litigation to prove that she's entitled to that protection, defense, and indemnity, and the insured successfully proves that she's entitled to that protection, I interpret the Elliott decision to say that it is equitable that further relief in the form of attorney fees as substantive relief be awarded to the insured to restore the financial protection that was promised by the insurance policy. I don't think that any other contract has as the very essence, as the very benefit provided, financial protection. And that is, I believe, how the Elliott Court distinguished the insurance policy from any other type of contract, and why the Elliott Court felt that the equitable principles, which it's permitted to consider, warranted an award of attorney fees.
This was a homeowner's, right?
This was a homeowner's policy.
So you don't know whether in a standard liability, say auto or otherwise, this reasonable expense provision is in it?
I have not reviewed another form of policy. I'd like to make a couple of other points. There have been concerns raised about predicting a flood of claims, about the punitive effect of this ruling. Attorney fees are only awarded under Elliott if the insurance company's coverage defenses are wrong. The only way I can imagine that awarding attorney fees in the limited circumstances presented in this case would lead to increase in costs or premiums is if insurance companies consistently advance erroneous coverage positions.
Well, there's a lot of close calls on coverage disputes, aren't there?
There are, and that's part of the underwriting process that an insurance company goes through when they're evaluating risks and setting premiums. They take those into consideration, and they're going to take into consideration the fact that there are going to be some coverage disputes that they may or may not win. But that's how the costs are spread around.
I think it's only inevitable that a construction of this insurance policy and a construction or a reading of Elliott in favor of your position will cause an increase in insurance premiums, because it's basically saying what Elliott means is that every insurance contract means or says is that I, the insurer, shift to you, the insurer, not only the cost of any defense should I get sued, but and the cost of paying any damages that I'm found liable to pay, but also the cost of any contract dispute between you and me, you know, you the insurance company and me the insured. And it's never before been interpreted that way, either Elliott or any insurance contract. This is a really novel argument, and I think it will inevitably result in an increase in insurance premiums. Reading of Elliott is adopted, and I don't see any basis in the standard insurance contract or in the one at issue in this case that stands for that proposition, that this risk-shifting exercise that we're engaged in when we negotiate an insurance policy means not only do I shift to you, insurance company, the underlying case, but I also shift to you, the insurance company, the cost of any dispute that should arise between us as to the applicability of this contract.
My time is out. May I respond?
Answer, please.
I guess I have two points. Low insurance premiums are of no benefit if you have to tack on thousands of dollars of attorney fees to litigate coverage to get the coverage you were supposed to get for your premiums. And secondly, I think the impact of the decision is to cause insurers to review their coverage determinations as carefully as they review their duties to defend, since the Elliott and the Newhouse decisions were handed down. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. Mr. Smith?
I think if we examine what the argument being offered by Mrs. Ben's counsel is that the insured should never have to pay more than premiums. And I think if you accept that argument, then the insurance company is going to end up having to pay even in cases where they win, even in cases where they're correct. If it's true that the insured never has to pay more than premiums, that's what the result is going to be.
But you forget there's one other scenario. That is when the plaintiff does not pursue the case because it would cost, the risk is too high. Then the insurance company pays zero.
I agree with that. What I'm talking about is...
my point is I have no idea what the figures are, but if in case 50 claims are not pursued, 50 legitimate coverage claims are not pursued because of the risk involved to the insured, the insurance company then may well have, in looking at taking a risk-benefit analysis, say that it's worthwhile to deny coverage on questionable claims. I don't know. I'd love to see some empirical evidence on that.
But I can't give you that, but I can give you my experience. I've been doing this for 9 years. I focus completely in insurance coverage issues. And I can tell you with the advent of mediation, and I can tell you about the way that litigation goes these days, if there is some type of a coverage issue, it may lessen the value of a claim, but in terms of having to pay zero, unless you're willing to go to the mat and get a ruling that there is no coverage whatsoever and fight any appeals. Typically, I think what you're finding nowadays with ADR and mediation is that many more cases get settled.
And then one other point here. I think you left out maybe unintentionally in explaining her position. I think her position is that when there is coverage...
I was getting to that.
Oh, okay.
I was going to get to that. If you look at it, it's either that they always, or that they never have to pay more than premiums, or that they only pay when the insurance company is right. And if you focus on who won and who lost, there is no equity in that. That's purely the English rule. It's purely an outcome determinative rule. There has to be something in the contract, something, some states, Ohio, Nebraska, New Hampshire, some of the cases I looked at in the Wisconsin Academy amicus brief, they've now been superseded by a statute that says that recovery of attorney fees is mandated in any case upon an insurance contract. So in those jurisdictions, the legislature has spoken and said that in cases, any action upon an insurance contract, there shall be recovery. Here, I don't think the court, I don't think, number one, with all due respect, it's the court's business to create such a statute by law or by decision, or to search for reasons that just aren't there in the contract. Well,
let me go back for a moment to the small claim issue that I raised in your initial argument, i.e., let's take a case where the attorney fees are $5,000 for both parties. The insurance, if coverage issue is pressed, and the exposure is $5,000. So the risk to the insured, the plaintiff, is $10,000. Because if the plaintiff loses in going after the insurance company, the plaintiff is going to have to pay $5,000 attorney fees as well as the $5,000 liability. Okay? You with me so far?
Yes.
Now, the exact same holds true for the insurance company as well, because if the insurance company loses, they're going to incur $5,000 attorney fees and a $5,000 liability claim. So, I put this to you now. The risk is exactly the same in terms of dollars to the insurance company as well as to the insured. $10,000. That's the risk that they take if they go to court. Nevertheless, unless you've got the extremely wealthy plaintiff, when you look at it in terms of the ability to pay this $10,000, there's no balance there at all. The insurance company is far better able take the risk of $10,000 than is a plaintiff. How do you respond to that?
I think you have to consider that you have both the plaintiff, like in this case, we have both the plaintiff, Mr. Reed, with capable counsel, and Ms. Metz, with capable counsel, combining forces in that situation. to oppose whatever coverage motion might be brought by any party, anything that might lead to them not having coverage. I still don't think that you can base an equitable distinction based on the particular facts of one risk scenario. But I do think you have to keep in mind that the plaintiff and the insured often combine, because this is a direct action statute, they combine for a direct action state, they combine forces against the insurance company. I hope that answered your question.
Mull it over lunch.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Smith. Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. If both of you would approach.